It's December 1st, 2018. This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast, and today Heather Flowers is here to talk about two dystopias, Extreme Meat Punks Forever and The World. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and as always, thanks for being here. So you may remember back in episode 38, this is Meat Punk and I'm Telling Everyone, that I spoke with Josie Brechner, also known as Visager, about her really excellent soundtrack for Powered by Blood, the first season of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. Well, today, I am talking to Heather Flowers, who made most of the rest of the game. There are other people's artwork in the game. We talk about that in the interview. But Heather is the writer, sort of main designer, developer, creative voice behind Extreme Meat Punks Forever. And it was really good to get to talk to her about subtlety being for fuckers, as the Meat Punk Manifesto says, about why this game kind of hit me so hard, why it is the way it is, sort of what choices felt important and urgent to her as far as the way it's designed and the way the story is told, the quirks of episodic storytelling, serialization, all that kind of stuff. It's a pretty good interview, I dare say. You do not have to have heard the Josie Brechner interview in order to make sense of this interview, but that one will definitely follow well if you're looking for more meat punky goodness. I hope you are all entering into a festive holiday season, finding some hope, and undermining fascism in whatever ways are available to you. Enjoy.
I'm recording now.
Okay, good. Okay. Would I be a total jerk if I asked you to describe the game one more time?
No, absolutely okay. Not.
All right.
Hello again. Sorry about that.
No worries. That's on me. Or,
I guess hello for the first time for those of you who are listening. I forgot to start recording the first time, so this is the second time we're doing this bit completely on me. It's totally fine. So I'm here today to talk about Extreme Meat Punks Forever Powered by Blood, which is a video game that I made with my own hands. That's a weird way of putting it. Whatever.
It has a very handmade artisanal quality to it, which we should talk about, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the basic premise of the game is it is a serialized episodic visual novel / mech brawler about gay disasters beating up neo-Nazis in giant robots made of meat. It takes place in this alternate universe version of the American Southwest, which is interesting because it's not more dystopian than our world. It's the same level, but more honest about it, I feel. So most pieces of technology are made out of meat, and there are neo-Nazis just crawling around everywhere. And it's a story about people trying to make do in this horrible world we live in.
Yeah, I think the eternal appeal of survival stories. I can't remember who said it. I'll have to look it up and put it in the show notes. But someone or other said, it's really fun to think about the end of the world because it's a scenario in which we no longer have to worry about the end of the world kind of thing. There's this appeal to just the idea of being out in the desert and you're on the run from fascists and there's no bullshit anymore. There's like you say, there's an honesty to it. It's not escapism in the sense of being fun to think about, but we live in our dystopia. The one we actually live in is so it traffics in ambiguity and disavowal and all that kind of stuff in a way that can be exhausting, I guess might be the word, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
That is not this world. And I love the phrase gay disasters too, right? Because none of the, the entire cast is gay and or bi and or trans. I guess you can't be gay and bi covering. You know what I mean? Nobody's straight, right? Nobody's cis and nobody is both cis and straight in our core cast. Which is great in the sense that it sort of makes the text uncooptable by the right, which they love to do. They love to take everything and somehow make it about them. This sort of denies them that. But it's also they're not from any of the stock gay villains or from any of the sort of saintly, saintly others that come from, they're just messed up people who are nonetheless really compelling and lovable, figuring out how to get through a really difficult situation. And it's it comes across as just shaggy and honest and great, in my opinion.
Thank you. Yeah, that That brings up an interesting point that I haven't really talked about much, which is, how do I phrase this? Like the temptation in making a game that is very much centered around body horror is to make the villains of the game be like look horrible, look physically disfigured. But if you do that, then you are doing the game itself a disservice, because like the point is that our enemies are people who look like us, and we need to accept that fact, and to other them is to wrongly
Yeah, to ascribe inward monstrousness to outward monstrousness in some way, that like when in fact you run into people in real life who are you know, disabled, who do not conform to normal state, like what the Greeks thought a body should look like or whatever, who are just people, right? Like maybe wonderful people, maybe terrible people, more than likely somewhere in between. Whereas horror very often conflates looking scary with being bad, and that's, it can be lazy, it can make the text less interesting, but it can also sort of, I don't know, recreate things that are not helpful, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, this game does not do that. And I love the way, too, that it just sort of, it draws the core cast. It, like, everybody has a color assigned to them. You know, Sam is blue, Leon is green. You know, like, I love the use of the palette there, because it really makes it pop when you see someone who's just gray, you know, and it's that your identity is what you perceive as a lack of identity. I thought that was a really smart way to, I don't mean to explain your game at you. I just, like, for people who haven't played it, you know, you don't even see anybody who may or may not be a fash for quite a while, but you immediately, they're described as gray. They're wearing grayscale. So, you know, the idea that white identity is partially based around the grievance of feeling like you don't have an identity and everyone else does, to me, like, that's a really good way of explaining that, the presence being absent or something.
Thank you. I also just wanted them to be boring.
That's important. That's important. I think it is important to tell a story about fascists and not make the fascists look cool, right? Which people seem to have a weirdly hard time with, you know? I mean, their version of cool anyway, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that is something, like, one of the things that fascists very much try to do is to make themselves look cool, which is why they have all those outfits and the iconography. It's supposed to look cool. So if you take that away and you realize that it's literally just a bunch of dorks who, like, are trying to do genocide and, like, other horrible shit, then you realize that there's nothing actually cool about that.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Like, the main villain in the first season of Miapunks is this survival prepper guy who's wearing this armor that he certainly thinks is cool, but it literally just looks like he welded a couple things together and then stuck it on his body.
Yeah, it looks like he missed the interesting parts of Mad Max, you know, as far as like, he just, yeah, it's just like kitchenware or something, or like bad LARPing. I love it. It looks so convincingly like something that an uncool person would think was cool, you know? Because, I mean, I love that too, right? That in a dystopia or a post-apocalypse or a apocalypse in progress or something like that, you would get people's different aesthetic senses. I think there are a lot of dystopias that miss out on that. You know, it all just kind of has a single wash over it. The idea of this prepper guy who's cobbled together this armor that he thinks is super awesome, but is just not, is delicious to me. But yeah, so I mean, the last time we talked on Twitter, you were saying you weren't sure there was going to be a second season, but you've here referred to the first season a bunch of times. Are you definitely planning to continue the story? It certainly ends on a bit of a cliffhanger without spoiling it.
I definitely want to continue on with the second season. It just will come down to a money thing. I will do my best to get to that point, and I don't doubt that I will eventually get to make it. It's just a question of when.
Yeah. Yeah,
and definitely. That might be like in a couple months, that might be in a couple years. It all just depends on like at what point am I financially stable enough to make this second game happen.
That's fair.
Like, I do have plans for a lot more in this world. Like, not just a second season, but a third and a couple other side things that will just kind of wink and nudge at for now.
That's fair. I mean, I love how much of it. I mean, I'm a real chump for stuff that doesn't really explain. In fact, my wife reads a ton of fantasy and you know, genre fiction in general. And every so often she'll be reading one and she'll just like turn to me and say, "You'll love this one. They don't explain anything." You know, like that. I always know I'm gonna not like a fantasy book too much if it has the phrase boiled leather in it too much, because if I know what everyone's wearing in a book, I just know it's not for me. I love when there's stuff that's just sort of dropped there, you know, in medias res, like Ursula Le Guin was really good at that. Octavia Butler is probably the best at that ever.
Yeah, definitely.
This game does that for sure. I mean, just like, you don't know what the deal is with the bright as opposed to the Sun for quite a while. The Sun cultists are just sort of a presence that are just there. Even the fact, the narrator sort of refuses to explain the basic premise that stuff runs on blood, that it is powered by blood. It's just like, well, the world's like ours, except for, well, you'll see, you know? So that leaves a ton of room to, you know, answer some of those questions and hopefully raise lots of other ones. You know, it's like, it's a world I do want to spend more time in for sure.
Thank you. Yeah. The part of the reason that I wanted to do that is because I feel like it is more, like you said, it is more rewarding when players figure it out for themselves. And part of it is because I feel like if you are just dropped into this other world, then nobody's going to have the time to explain everything to you because there's so much that's different. Like the entire first episode could just be like, here is a mech, here is what a nerve spike is, here's what's up with the Sun. But it's so much more interesting to see that happening in action and to explain through actions and through plot events rather than just through saying, here is what is up with this world.
Yeah, yeah. From A, either a giant exposition dump, or then B, the sort of character who's as confused as you are, usually like a kid who's come through a portal or something. usually the blandest character in the story. Like it denies you that, which is great. You know, everybody has a point of view on the events that are happening and everything that happened before and just the way the world works.
Yeah, definitely. And the other reason is because I wanted people to focus less on how the world works and more on what the world working the way it does, how that makes you feel. Because I couldn't tell you how a meat mech works. You couldn't tell me how one works. It doesn't matter. I could tell you that it's magic and you would have to accept that. Or I could tell you that it's like this weird genetic engineering stuff and you would have to accept that too. But that's less interesting than what it means for the people who actually pilot them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it again relates to our experience of our actual dystopian timeline, because I think everybody deals with technology that is at some level a black box to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just sort of take on faith that it works the way it works, or it starts to make sense to you. Even when you take a step back, you're like, oh, well, our smartphones have conflict minerals in them, and the brushed aluminum on the MacBook that I'm recording this on can cause explosions and in fact has blown people up. Like you take a step back and you think about the means of production and the process of production, and it becomes horrifying. So I love the idea of a characters who take as normal something that is outwardly horrifying in sort of a body horror way at first blush, but that you're denied the sort of gentle introduction. I thought it was really effective.
Thank you.
And I also love, so, I mean, like, the presence of Sam. Like, Sam has, this is, like, spoilers for episode one. Like, the first scene thereof. And we can get as spoilery as you want, by the way, but I figure we'll give people some spoiler clemency for the first couple of minutes or so.
That's fair.
Sam has experience with the meat mechs, but just for agricultural applications, which, of course, makes perfect sense. If you had meat mechs, you would totally use them to thresh wheat and all that stuff. So he's never fought with them, whereas some other folks, you know, that's all they use them for. The idea of technology as neutral, right? It's not like everything's bespoke. It's not like the killing curse or whatever. Like, it has one purpose. These are just like, they're just machines. They could be used for good, for ill, for commercial purposes, or to take down capitalism or whatever, you know? I love that touch.
Essentially, the world building rule that I have is that if something in our world would be a vehicle, then in their world it would be some kind of mech. So, for example, like agriculture equipment with wheels would become a mech, or a car would become a mech, or a motorcycle would become a meter cycle.
yeah,
which is something that I plan on getting to at some point.
I'm already charmed by that. Yes, awesome. And also the periphery of it, right? Like, you end up in a blood station at one point, and you're kvetching about I can't remember who says it. Maybe it's Cass who says, like, we're gonna have to be eating blood station sushi for a while, right? Like, the idea that you can sort of copy paste that stuff and it's not necessarily more or less weird than actual reality is is endlessly intoxicating. I do want to kind of talk about the handmade quality of the game, because you said, like, you made it with your hands, and you did, and it feels like you did, but that is a strange thing to say about a piece of digital art, right?
Yeah.
It kind of goes back and forth between two complementary but somewhat distinct, maybe three, visual styles. Like, there are sort of splash pages that are very, very hand-drawn. Then there are, like, characters who, again, look pretty hand-drawn, but on top of, like, ASCII art, like colorful, gradient-heavy somehow really feels like the Southwest ASCII art. And then the actual meat mech piloting is sort of like, I don't know exactly how to describe it. It's a bit glitchy. It's very low pixel. It's impressionistic to the, you know, it sort of invites you to imagine all the gore rather than depicting any of it for you. But it's all this stuff kind of mashed together. So like, did that sort of variety arise out of necessity and just like, you know, making what you could as quick as you could, or was that part of the idea from the beginning?
It was partially a necessity thing. It was also partially a ideological thing, because like I very much wanted to incorporate a DIY aesthetic, and that is the easiest and best way to do it.
Totally.
And it was partially just I wanted to work with as many of my artist friends as possible.
Yeah.
So there are like 5 different artists in the game, I think. For example, Amy Zhang did all of the character art in the visual novel sections, and that's great. But anything that wasn't done by a professional artist, and you can very much tell what wasn't done by a professional artist, was done by me either with ASCII art or just like trying to draw random shapes in GIMP and hoping that something looks like something. Mm. Basically anything that has random numbers and letters stuck inside it somewhere is my art.
Yeah. Well, the game though doesn't, it's tough to explain how I even got this impression, but I definitely walked away with the impression that it doesn't privilege the quote unquote polished art over the messier stuff. You know, it all really is of a piece, and I don't know. It felt very, very punk and very human in that sense.
Thank you. Yeah. I wanted to just put as many art styles into one game as possible.
Totally. Yeah, so I mean, like, is that part of what makes it punk? That multiplicity, the like the come as you are kind of thing.
I personally feel like that's part of the punk aesthetic of the game. I mean, like that, in my opinion, punk is more about a specific political statement and how you say it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, what makes meat punks truly punk? In my opinion, like there are 1,000 definitions of punk for every person who exists on this planet. is that it has a very specific leftist message, and it says that message as angrily and loudly as possible.
Yeah, that's where it gets interesting, right? Because there are a lot of versions of punk that, in order to be as loud and to get as much attention as possible, will appropriate stuff that is outside of or even antithetical to its actual message. You know, like famously, there were punks who appropriated Nazi imagery. I guess it depends on who you ask, whether there was a Nazi element among those punks or whether they were just trying to freak people out. But of course, there was a backlash to that. Nazi punks fuck off and all that stuff. That can be really interesting, right? And it can make it both more and less legible. You know, like there's something about your desire to be honest about what the dystopia is and to have clarity. And we can talk about the manifesto in more detail in a sec. But the idea that subtlety is for fuckers, right? That is both utterly in line with punk, or at least certain kinds of punk, and a little bit different than the way some punks operate. Because I think like with some punk, at least to an outsider, the message can be inscrutable. They just get the anger, the noise. Like the leftism can maybe get lost or feel encoded. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there's definitely a multiplicity in punk, which is that everybody will have their own definition and everybody will have their own set of tastes for what punk is. So for example, I tend to go for more like melodic punk, like dance punk and folk punk. Because I just can't understand what people are saying with the more noisy punk.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a lyrics like, guy, so I have the same struggle. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I love Dyke Drama, but if I listen to a Glask album, it's just me questioning whether I'm hearing people saying words for a couple minutes.
Yeah. You're just kind of squinting at it like a monk with a faded manuscript or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just because I can't fucking hear, but
there's that too. Yeah. I went to a lot of clubs when I was younger and, you know, I pay for it a little bit, but especially in the upper range. Yeah, that's true. I mean, like that's exactly it, right? Like the sense in which this game is undeniably punk as fuck is that it contains multitudes in that way. It has all these different impulses and aesthetics, and it's not actually super concerned with whether they gel per se. It's more just like about what you take away from that multiplicity. And like that feels like a healing balm right now when everyone is in our dystopia is so concerned with like, well, what am I? Am I a democratic socialist or what? You know, like they're not so concerned with the takeaway. They're more concerned with what box everything has to fit into. And it can be, again, exhausting.
Yeah, definitely. Screw boxes. Some boxes are good, but most boxes are bad.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Yeah. you need some boxes, right? You need, you can't, you have to parcel out reality in some kind of useful terminology, and you know, you need a system of classification eventually, but the impulse to put everything into that kind of rigid structure is just, it's, it can be really corrosive really quickly.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Bringing that back to the game, that's sort of a lot of the feelings that I have about the character of Cass, who throughout the entire first season spends a lot of that time being put into boxes by other people.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so for example, like, spoilers ahead, I guess, for the entirety of the first season. Not the entirety,
yeah,
but like,
we're roughly 20 minutes in, so I will say, this be the line, here be spoilers. Yeah. If you haven't played the game, check it out. I think it's super worth your time. It's not expensive, it's on itch, it's great, play it. Okay, spoiler time.
Okay, so, like, Cass is a character who everybody has different expectations on. So, for example, in episode 2, everybody immediately elects them the leader just because they seem to have their shit together, though, like, they super don't. And so they try and live up to this standard, but people just keep not understanding the kind of person that they actually are, which is extremely depressed and not wanting any of this.
Yeah.
And so, like, they hold it together okay, but by the end of the first season, they're about to collapse. And then this is also something that sort of comes up again because Cass is non-binary and, like, certain characters, especially, like, the final boss at the end, who's, like, a huge creep and stalked Cass for a while, actually misgenders them.
Intentionally and pointedly, yes. And repeatedly, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think Cass is the character who most represents that most boxes are bad, but boxes are good. Because, you know, everyone's a disaster. Cass is Cass might be the person who is best positioned to be the leader, but that still doesn't mean they're going to carry that burden well. You know, they don't fit into boxes easily, as is slightly inherent to non-binary identity, but they're also the one who, when they meet new people, you know, want to make sure that everyone says their pronouns. You know, like, those, that's not really a box, I suppose. It's more just like, it's knowing how to use English in a way that doesn't hurt people, but it's like, it's necessary, right? Like, it's a structural, that, like, in my head, that was part of why they thought, why everybody, I should say, thought the cast might make a good leader, was that point of order never gets lost. And that's something you need in a leader, but it's just survival for them, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Like, the reason that they asked for everybody to say pronouns wasn't for Liana, because Liana's cis, it was for themselves.
Right, totally.
And, like, it just happened to also help Brad in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Liana, nobody really misgenders Liana. I mean, Liana presents as female. Like, that part's obvious. All the things that might make people uncomfortable or intimidated about Liana have less to do with gender and more to do with everything else, you know?
The fact that she is just a very scary person.
Yeah. My favorite line in the entire, as long as we're doing spoilers, I really love the touch. I think Cass says it, that Liana is allergic to potatoes, but is quote-unquote not a coward, and so eats them anyway. That's perfect. I mean, that is very much in line with some punk folks I've known in my life, you know.
Yeah, it's specifically based off my own experiences with lactose intolerance.
So you feel similarly? You refuse to kowtow to your own lactose intolerance?
Yeah, I'm not a coward. I'll do it. I'll drink an entire carton of milk. Just watch me.
I'm aware. I go in knowing the consequences. I accept them. I admire that. I do. Because it's true. Like, I mean, that is... There are so many people who will walk 20 miles to avoid a minor discomfort and, like, miss out on a lot in life because of that. And that's, I mean, like, that's, you know, to consume something that you are explicitly allergic to or intolerant of or whatever is maybe, like, a slightly more straightforward than ordinary example of that. But the idea of just, like, no, we don't have to organize society around niceties and avoiding minor discomforts. We can just power through and, like, live life. I think, you know, it's thematically resonant to the rest of the game, that little
moment. Definitely. I will say that none of the four main characters has the entire answer to the problems of the world.
Right.
Like, I didn't want a single character to be right. There is no real main character in the game. Mm-hmm. There actually was in the original design docs for the game, and then we never really figured out what to do with that character. Like, they just weren't interesting. So eventually we said, screw main characters. We're going to make the entire game about these four, like, relatively minor side characters.
Interesting. So, like, so it's not as though the original protagonist morphed into one of our four. This was a different character who just got cut because they weren't interesting enough.
Yeah. I mean, technically, Sam's original storyline was based around the fact that he is the main character's best friend. So when the main character got cut, then that role got relegated to Jason. And a lot of Sam's early storyline is about him dealing with his best friend being gone.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I guess technically the protagonist of the game is Jason, who is the tutorial side character.
I kind of love that. Because it so means that we're off the save the cat map, you know, so quickly. Like, yeah, this is our protagonist structurally, and he's gone. You know, it's like, that's great. I mean, because he's the inciting incident. You know, he's like, he's what kicks off. We start with Sam. We meet everybody else quickly. But Sam is we meet the Meat Punks around the time Sam does. Like, the group kind of comes together and coalesces structurally around Sam just needing somewhere to kind of go that night. I mean, and Cass too, for sure. That's really interesting to know, because I mean, we were just talking about how when you try to put a character, you know, to be the reader insert or the player insert, you can sometimes have nowhere to go with that, right? Because you can, there's only so much narrative juice to get out of people explaining things to you accurately. Explaining things to you inaccurately has a ton of narrative juice, but is maybe a dangerous thing to do in a game somewhat, right? Because, you know, people do need to be able to operate it at the end of the day, unlike with other media.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So speaking of operating it, I think it's notable that all of the fights in the game are skippable. When you die, it doesn't do the Metal Gear Solid 5 thing and like give you like it doesn't offer you stupid idiot baby mode or something. It just says, would you like to try again? You know, would you like to switch characters or would you like to skip this? You might be able to hear a cat. Sorry if that's distracting.
That's fine.
I'm in my mom's house right now, actually. And she's a cat who demands attention. It just says, like, would you like to try again or would you like to skip it? Would you mind talking a little bit about like why you did that? You know, whether it was about, well, yeah, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Why'd you do that?
Okay, so there were a couple different reasons to do that. First off, it's a pretty big accessibility thing, I feel. Like, I wanted to put as much functional accessibility into the game as possible, and I wasn't able to get everything in because I am, like, one person. but the fights in the game are intentionally difficult, and the controls are intentionally kind of wonky and hard to control. And the farther you go in the fights, the more exhausted your characters get and the harder they are to control. And so that's a very interesting design space to play with, but also it means that the fights are, for a certain group of people, just straight up unfun. And so giving people the option to skip fights, especially during the less fun sections, the more challenging sections, was, I felt like, an essential thing.
Yeah. I think unfun is accurate. I mean, like, in an interesting way, right? Like, the mechs, especially as you get tired, feel unwieldy in about the way you would expect a meat mech to feel, right? Like, it's an interesting choice. It doesn't just feel like, oh, this was implemented wrong. It feels like, oh, this is wonky for a reason. But I can totally see how for some people that's not fun, and for some people it's probably literally impossible to wrangle.
Yeah, definitely. There are actually only two fights in the game that you can't skip. And those are the fight between Brad and Liana in the start of episode 4 and the final boss fight.
That makes sense. Yeah, because the final boss fight, I was so determined that I never lost that one. I was my head was really in the game, so I didn't see the game over screen such as it was on that one. And then the Brad and Liana fight, there's no failure state per se. So it's you know, even if it's 4-0 not in your favor, you can just sort of the story continues.
Yeah, definitely. In the Brad and Liana fight, there's no failure state because either way, things end up patching up afterwards.
Right.
But in the final boss fight, there's no win state.
Yeah, totally.
There is a story difference between winning and losing. If you win the fight, then the final boss dies. But if you lose the fight, then he actually gets away and becomes another, and like becomes a bigger problem in season 2.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
So he's another character that I now have in my roster to pull out at any time. A lot of serialized game development isn't actually about like knowing specific plot lines. It's about putting in little anchors that you can hook back to later.
Yeah, and the game, the DIY aesthetic, it seems to me, makes it a lot easier to actually have those consequences follow you in a way that I think, you know, when you lift the veil from, I mean, RIP Telltale, I guess, but even from Telltale's best work, you know, there were always fewer consequential choices than there appeared to be. And the trick worked well enough while you were playing through the first time, but if you actually sort of examined what the differences were, it was never quite as much as they sort of implicitly promised. It seems to me that you have the potential with something like this to actually have those consequences follow you. And that's fascinating to me. And it also seems like it could be unwieldy, you know, at any level of production, to have all those pieces potentially in play and to try and make maybe not every choice meaningful, but right, but both ones you would expect and ones you might not expect to turn out to be important. It's just a lot of pieces to keep in your head.
Yeah, definitely. It's actually interesting looking at a graph of the entirety of Meat Punk Season 1. Like, it's very much a linear game, and that's not something that I really want to deviate from too much. But the entire thing sort of looks like a braid because you're constantly splitting off and seeing one side of a conversation or the other side. And so when characters come back together, you have to reckon with whatever decisions they made while they were talking to each other and you weren't listening.
Right.
But also, almost every scene has parts of it that were written four times over because the results of a scene change based on what mech pilot was previously fighting. So, like, who's most tired in the scene, who's, like, angriest about the previous mech fight, who just got beat up. That's something that sort of comes back, especially when interesting things happen on the road. Like, in episode 4, there's a bit where you meet your clone, who's just sort of wandering around in the desert. But whose clone it actually is depends on who's fighting.
Yeah, I saw Cass's clone. I got taken by surprise. I just felt like fighting as Cass at that moment.
Yeah. Did you fight Cass's clone or did you do the other option?
To be honest, I was so amped up, I didn't know there was another option. I did fight the clone.
Yeah. Three out of the four characters have options where you end up not fighting the clone. Liana just immediately jumps into fight.
Interesting,
But if you go as Cass, you can either fight the clone or you can talk to the clone and open up about your depression.
I got to go back and do that.
Yeah.
the depression and, you know, the really heavy conversation about suicide ideation and all of that. It was great. And I do love the other thing that I love about the way the game sort of opens up and lets you behind the curtain a little bit, like acknowledges that you're hearing a story and all of that, is it allows the narrator to pretty unobtrusively say stuff like, you know, one of these two options gets pretty heavy, you know, be warned. You know, like, I think traditional narrative game design theory would be that that breaks the flow or breaks immersion, whatever that is. So you shouldn't do that. The whole point is to gut punch the player and take them by surprise and whatever. To not do that, I think actually weirdly makes it more impactful because, like, to prepare myself and then, you know, and then see that happen was really effective for me. I don't know.
Thank you. And yeah, there are parts where I do decide to go for the gut punch, like like the ending, definitely. But one of the first choices in the entire game, and this is something that I'm very proud of because it like sets the tone for the kind of choices that players eventually have to make later down the line, is like after you do the first tutorial fight and you're playing as Sam and you are hiding in this cornfield with Jason, one of the options of things you can say is, I think I'm in love with you. Mm-hmm. And if you click that option, what Sam says instead is, I'm really going to miss you.
Yeah.
And
that got me.
Yeah. It's like you get the gap between what he actually wanted to say and what he ended up really saying. And that was a really interesting narrative space for me to play in. So I do like the playing with options that don't turn out the way that you want them to. But in that case, I felt like it was such a heavy topic, I couldn't not content warning it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's interesting because with the Sam moment, the character development lives in the gap between what, you know, you in his head are saying he wants to say and what he's sort of capable of saying to that person in that moment. With the Cass moment, it's more like, I mean, it's a revelation, right? Like plot-wise and emotionally and whatever, it's them opening up about something that they have not yet been able to open up about, you know, maybe even not able to think about. So it lives in that space where, you know, warning and saying like straightforwardly, this is what we're talking about makes a ton of sense. And I think that's why it doesn't break the flow and why a gut punch would be maybe not cheap, but less appropriate in that moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. The game does a really good job of having you jump from character to character in terms of their perspective. I mean, it really doesn't feel like, as you say, like there's any one protagonist. It feels like our group of four, it's all of their story. And that goes as far as you say, you know, who's tired, who's sort of at the center of a given scene, who's talking to who. That sort of, it made me think of Kentucky Route Zero, right? That thing where the braid, where you're off in a room and you quote unquote miss something as a result, but your experience feels more personal. And it's also just like the phrasing, you know, just like the options that you pick, like every little thing really, you know, Liana goes for it and, you know, and Sam hesitates and all that stuff. That stuff is really, really baked into every little word choice in a way that I think some people maybe miss because the sort of the syntax and the capitalization and all that stuff is casual in a way that maybe to some players reads like, oh yeah, someone just typed a first draft. But as soon as you start paying attention, you're like, no, that's that simplicity is hiding the interesting complexity. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, thank you. It's interesting that you bring up Kentucky Route Zero because that was actually a huge inspiration for me while writing this game. Not necessarily in tone, because tonally Kentucky Route Zero is extremely different, but like they do come from a similar emotional place, I feel. Like that sense of being lost in this bizarre world where things only sort of make sense. Like, yeah. I definitely wouldn't call Meat Punk's magical realist because that's just objectively false. But I do feel like it, in some sense, was inspired by the way that magical realism deals with supernatural events.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that connection hadn't occurred to me. It occurred to me that it was like Kentucky Route Zero in that it is dreamlike, in that it is, I felt like, and there are more concrete examples of this in Kentucky Route Zero than in Meat Punks, I think, but the idea that when you're selecting your character's dialogue choices, it's not just what you're saying, but like the world gives you a yes and, you know what I mean? Like someone asks you what your dog's name is, and then that's your dog's name for the rest of the game. Like it's the idea of improvising a little bit. I definitely got the impression in Meat Punks more that the world is what it is and you're more reacting to it, but it still had that same dreamlike quality because it is in medias res of like, okay, I'm all four of these people. I'm figuring out who they are. They're figuring out who they are. We're in that together. So like it felt like a similar way of using dialogue in that sense, rather than just, you know, am I going to be nice shepherd or mean shepherd in this moment or something?
Yeah, definitely. Like a lot of the dialogue choices in the game are much less about like what will this character be doing at this time. It's a lot more about what is this character feeling and how are they reacting to the present moment, and like what specific thing do you want to say and hear a response to.
Yeah, absolutely. The episodic thing, was that also sort of inspired a bit by Kentucky Route Zero in the sense that it gives both you and the player time to sort of, you know, ruminate on what's happened so far before seeing what's going to happen next?
Not much time on my end.
Okay, but fair enough.
Yeah. The episodic thing was largely based from Kentucky Route Zero and other games like Life is Strange, because I thought it was an interesting design space to play in, but also it was a scheduling thing. Like, I wanted to start getting the game out this summer, and if I released all six episodes at the same time, that just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. You would be spending more time working on a game that you couldn't sell to anybody yet, which is a tough place to be in.
Yeah. If I went back, I'm not 100% sure if I would go the episodic route again, but it does seem to have largely worked.
As a player, I really like it because it allows for a kind of water cooler conversation, for lack of a less stupid term, that other games kind of lack. You know, if someone's playing, like, even if we're all playing a massive game like Red Dead Redemption 2, which I haven't played yet, but people are playing it and they're talking about it. You know, one person's experience, it's not just that it's going to be different. It may have nothing to do with each other. Or Breath of the Wild or something, right? Like someone may have run off in one direction. Someone may have run off in another. You can sort of enthuse about it together, but you can't talk about like, well, what did you do in this moment in the same way that you can with a mostly linear, tightly scripted, episodic thing like Meat Punks, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I remember when episode 3 came out, I got to see so many people tweeting with the hashtag like super scared about what was going to happen in episode 4, because the end of episode 3 is like two characters get in a really big fight and say we're going to like physically fight each other, and whichever of us loses has to leave.
Yeah.
And like that specific stakes rising got a lot of people interested in what was going to happen next.
I thought that was such a well-handled moment too, if I just may praise you at you a little longer. I don't know if that's great radio, but it's...
I'm very vain, so...
So it actually works out great. Okay. Yeah. No, but it was a credible threat. Like, the idea that somebody would have to leave the group absolutely felt like a real possibility. And yet it didn't in any way feel like a cop-out when no one did. The idea that these characters can have real, non-bullshit conflict with each other, but then work it out was such like a beautiful bonding moment, you know?
Yeah, thanks. That was partially because I just didn't want to write the rest of the entire game with just three characters, and I wouldn't necessarily know which three characters.
Yeah. We're getting into the same problems Telltale ran into there, right?
Like... Yeah. But also, I feel like the reason that it worked as not a cop-out is because it felt more like a relief.
Exactly.
Like, at that point, you don't want either character to leave, so when neither does, it just feels like that's a good thing.
Yeah, it also, I think, wouldn't have worked quite as well if not for the fact that both characters had a point. Like, neither was completely being reasonable, but neither had an illegitimate grievance, you know? So it felt like I've been in that fight where I feel like I can't back down, but, you know, if I could take a step back, I would know that that there's no point in the conflict, but in that moment, there's no way I'm going to see that. Like, again, it felt real. It didn't feel like now is the time where the group breaks up or something, you know, and that kind of, it's lose main character time in the JRPG. It just felt like, you know, it seemed like a natural outgrowth of where those characters were, and it felt like a legitimate step forward without somebody having to, like, you know, get new powers or something kind of heavy-handed like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the cast of characters expands in episode 6. Is the plan to just kind of keep zooming out the world in that sense? I mean, I assume anybody we've seen, we at least have a chance of meeting again. But is part of the joy for you of, like, continuing to build out the world to see how different people are living in different places? Because we've really only seen two cities and the waste in between so far.
Yeah, definitely. I want, a lot of season 2 is based around expanding the world and expanding character interactions. So much of season 1 is actually boilerplate stuff, just getting the basic character dynamics where they need to be so that I can do interesting things with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so season 2 is going to be focusing on a new area of the world called the Rose Arcs, which is sort of a combination of the Rocky Mountains and the Ozarks, because I like mountains, I guess.
When we've done deserts, so, you know, it's a logical step.
Yeah, and so it's going to be a lot bigger, if that makes sense, because, like, we already have the cast of, like, the main 10 or 12 or however many characters, and many of those are going to keep coming back, and when you see them again, they're going to have changed, and they're going to tell you about what they've been up to during their time, and we might get to follow a couple new characters around and see what they're up to, and... like, I have plans to sort of interact with other areas of the world, because we've only been in the, like, American Southwest so far, but there are so many other interesting, weird locations to delve into.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love that idea, because I'm sort of obsessed with the regional character of different parts of the U.S. I think I've hit the whole lower 48 at this point, There's weird, sometimes ugly magic to every single part of the country that is, you just, I don't know, and, like, people from there carry a little bit of it with them, and you get these weird combinations of it when people have lived in different places. Like, it's underexplored, and I think people who aren't from the U.S. don't get just sort of the vastness and the strangeness and all the little things hidden in pockets of the U.S., because it's not like Europe where you drive for a little bit and you're in a different country with a different language and whatever. Like, it's still the U.S., and yet it's not the one you know. And again, that's true in our current dystopia as well as the Meat Punks one, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So one thing I want to bring up before you have to go. Did you by any chance read the Broken Earth trilogy, N.K. Jemisin? I think she just finished it up last year.
I have not.
Okay. I just had to bring it up because the again, we're in spoiler territory, but the whole thing about stealing the sun really reminded me of that book, because, like, you I guess spoilers for that as well. I've spoiled this like 3 times on this podcast because I love these books so much. It's the first series ever to win 3 Hugos. Like, every book in the trilogy won. Yeah, she's so good. But the big reveal at the end of the first book is that so the world is strange, right? Like, there's constant earthquakes, and there are these wizards basically called Orogenes who can sort of control tectonic plate movement with their brains, and they're needed but they're feared. And the big reveal at the end of the first book is that happened because the moon got stolen. And so then the rest of the series has to do with, like, figuring out what to do about that, and, like, who stole it and why and what powers were we trying to harness. And I don't know. It was a really potent metaphor for climate change being our fault. And I think about the same way that the stealing of the sun in Meat Punks was. So I couldn't resist asking whether that was just synchronicity or whether that had been an influence at all.
It was synchronicity. I could talk about the sun for a little bit. The fact that the sun essentially exists as this bizarre, almost nuclear weapon yeah. in this universe. It's partially because I have just held a deep-seated, long-held, joking hatred towards the sun. Like, I made a game before called Help Me Kill the Sun, and like the sun has been a villain in a couple other games that I've made, and I just keep posting about how the sun doesn't actually really exist. It's just a cardboard cutout.
It's a trickster god, actually. But
yes, it's a trickster god. and so I wanted to deal with like nuclear anxiety, definitely. Everything just getting obliterated in an instant, combined with climate change for obvious reasons. And also, like, the game has very much a religious nature to it, because I grew up deeply Christian, and I don't necessarily hold those beliefs anymore, but living in that kind of society really affected my worldview in a way, and I want to explore what it feels like when it feels like those things are real. Yeah. Like, the sun is just straight up God for a couple of the characters.
Yeah, for Brad during his upbringing. And then, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. That's really fascinating. The idea that the world contains something that's like supernatural or beyond, and that is not... It doesn't feel like an article of faith. It doesn't feel like something you're making yourself believe. It just feels like it is. It's just a fact.
Yeah, definitely.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm definitely fascinated by that idea. And I also love the idea that we don't really know how the bright works. That mm-hmm. to me feels very resonant in kind of these Elon Musk-y times where it's like, let's go ahead and, you know, who cares about the Earth? Cause we'll all go live on Mars. I love the idea of like, well, we the sun has been put to other purposes. So we have a perfect replacement for it and it works flawlessly, except of course when it doesn't, that stuff felt really good, but I had not made the religious connection. I did not grow up especially religious. And if you have to go, we do not have to open this can of fish, but you know, that element of it was, I could definitely see it playing at the margins. It's explicit with the sun cultists and stuff. But that's definitely a cool theme to keep in mind as I revisit it and as I play more of it, as you make more of it.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was great.
Yeah, glad you enjoyed it. Is there anything else you want to plug in the meantime, or is it all Meat Punks all the time these days?
It's less extreme Meat Punks forever and more moderate Meat Punks some of the time right now.
Fair enough.
I'm in the middle of taking a break. I'm going to be focusing more on smaller games for the time being while I like build up a more stable base, and then I'll take a run at Meat Punk Season 2.
That's fantastic. I love that. And yeah, I mean, I'm very happy to just tell everybody out there, you know, if you're looking for a game to play at the end of the year, something that is enormous in thematic scope, but small in terms of the number of hours it asks from you, like, this really fills that space and it'll live in your head. You can kind of just sit down and play through it, but it's also great to play it in the episodic chunks in which it was originally released. I seriously can't recommend it highly enough to someone who's looking for something beautiful and strange. So I hope people check it out. I know there are some weirdos who are listening to this who will definitely check it out. And enjoy your break, and I'm so excited to see what you make next.
Thank you. You have a good one.
You too. And that's the show. Thanks again to Heather for this conversation. Thanks again to Josie for the previous conversation, as well as for the rather splendid music you are currently hearing. Extreme Meat Punks Forever, powered by Blood, is available on Itch. The soundtrack is available on Bandcamp. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with all manner of assistance from fellow disasters Lucio Valentino and Francis Michelle Lopez. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbay, Stitcher. I always say Podbay. Is Podbay still a thing? Anyway, Podbay, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Podcast Addict, which I just learned about. And hey, Spotify. The feud is over. We're on Spotify. We are, however, currently unavailable at Blood Stations due to an incident. There was a bit of a recall. It's under control. Don't worry about it. You can also find everything we do at etao.blog.